I've entitled it Missionaries in an Alien Culture, and I'm going to make a couple of references to begin with from the book of Acts, the first one in Acts chapter 14. However, I'm not going to spend this session as an exposition of biblical data. This session is just a collection of miscellaneous observations which I made during our missionary service in Thailand, and I'm presenting them to you as something that you might think about. Some of the things I say may be relevant to one country, but not necessarily to another. However, I think that you're sufficiently interested in missionary work to be able to see some of the underlying considerations and hopefully adapt them for yourselves. I should trust that out of this audience there are going to be quite a number who finish up in God's service in different countries of the world. Now, in Acts chapter 14, we have this issue of language and culture arising when Paul came to Lystra in verse 8 and healed a crippled man. The people, of course, would have all spoken Greek. Greek was spoken universally, but different people in different localities also had their own languages. And in verse 11, the people of this locality spoke in the Lycaonian language. Paul didn't speak Lycaonian, and he didn't understand what was going on. The people had gone and collected some animals, and they were going to offer them to Paul and Barnabas as sacrifices. In verse 12, they call Barnabas Zeus, and they call Paul Hermes. They were Greek gods. Well, the people thought that here in Paul and Barnabas was an incarnation of some of the Greek gods. But all this preparation was going on, it must have taken some time, and Paul and Barnabas were totally unaware of what was happening. That is precisely what can happen when a person lives in another culture and doesn't understand the language. The real way to understand the culture of the people is through the language. We can live in a place and still not really understand what's going on because we haven't understood the language. The sacrifices were about to be offered when Paul and Barnabas twigged to what was happening. They almost tore their hair out and they said to these people, "Look, take away those animals, don't offer sacrifices to us." And they took the opportunity then to preach the gospel to them. And so there you have a case of misunderstanding the language and with it misunderstanding the culture. Now if you go to chapter 21, we have the opposite case. Here, Paul was in Jerusalem. The mob had attacked him, and he had been rescued by one of the Roman army officers. Paul asked the Roman army officer for permission to speak to the people, and the officer gave him permission. That's referred to in chapter 21, verse, very last sentence actually of chapter 21. Paul stood on the steps, and he addressed the crowd in the Hebrew tongue. Now previously, he'd spoken to the army official in Greek, that's in verse 37. But when he spoke to the people, they were his own people, and he spoke to them in the Hebrew language. In verse 2 of the following chapter, when the people heard that he addressed them in the Hebrew language, they were quiet and they listened. Immediately, he had them listening. And so he proceeded then, for the next 20 verses, to preach to them. And they understood what he was saying. They understood only too well, because when he got to verse 21 and said that God had sent him to preach to the Gentiles, in verse 22, they listened no longer. Uproar broke out. You can see the point. The difference when a person understands or when he doesn't understand the local language and culture. Now, there's no guarantee that simply because you speak the local language and understand the local culture that therefore you're going to be successful. An interesting comment on these two illustrations I've given is that in the case of Lystra, even though Paul had almost got himself a king-sized problem because of his misunderstanding of the local language, in spite of all that, he was able to turn the situation around to his own benefit and preach the gospel and people believed. Here, in the second illustration, even though he did speak the language and he knew the culture and they understood him, he got no converts and in fact the people tried to attack him. So that's an interesting spin around in both of those cases. But the point is made, I think, that the way to understand is through the language, but that in itself is not going to guarantee success. Nevertheless, we have to devote ourselves fully and completely to understanding the language, and that's where I'm going to start speaking now, making a start with our language study. This in itself is a whole subject, so I'm going to dismiss it fairly briefly, but I feel it's so important it must at least get a mention in this talk this afternoon. It may take 12 or 18 months of pretty well full-time study to learn the language, and it's going to be hard work and we have to be brainwashed. I was very thankful in Thailand that we were in a country that had no previous history of British involvement. English is not spoken, except around the tourist traps and in the higher places of international business dealings. But the average person doesn't understand or speak English, And if you're going to work at all, then you have to speak Thai. And so that's a very good incentive to learn the language. I was very thankful that we learnt the language from teachers who themselves had very little English. They didn't teach us by comparing it with English. We didn't have lists of words, learning vocabularies. We didn't learn it in relation to English at all. Even after 2 or 3 weeks, if we wanted to ask our teachers questions, we had to do so in whatever Thai we had. They forced us to use the Thai language. We learned for several months simply to understand and then to speak before we learned to read and write. It's very rare to have a language taught in that way, but it's the best way. Learn to hear, understand and speak, and only then learn to read and write. That's the way, as little children, we learn to hear and to speak first, and only later, after we can hear and speak quite well, only then do we learn to read and write. That's the way we did it in Thai. And through this method, we had a tremendous advantage over people who live in countries where there's a high level of English, and so less incentive to study, and also a greater inclination on the part of teachers to compare everything all the time to English. One must sympathise with people who are trying to learn a foreign language in a country where English is sufficient for anybody to get by. It's much more helpful if there's no English to get by with, and you're forced to use the language that you're learning. You have to get to the stage where you allow yourself to be brainwashed. You seem to cross an invisible line, and you find that you're thinking and dreaming and moving in a whole world of the Thai language, and that is in a separate compartment in your mind from the English language. There is no connection between the two. You don't translate as you go along. They are simply in separate compartments. We in the English-speaking world are at a great disadvantage because most of us speak only one language. But right across the world, you'll find that the majority of people speak at least two languages. And so we find it more difficult in learning another language, particularly when we're well up in adult years when we come to tackle the task. I was determined to get the language, and I even limited my own reading so that I didn't read in English over those 12 or 18 months apart from my Bible. Occasionally I might have read something in English, but I didn't buy an English newspaper. All I did was write letters and read letters from home and read my Bible. And everything else, I was determined to soak myself in the Thai language so that my mother tongue would more or less be put out of my mind. We only spoke English to one another in the house, and in fact all our years in Thailand we spoke English to nobody else except each other in the house or the occasional missionary or other foreigner that we might happen to meet. Now you might say that's fairly drastic, but I believe it's necessary if we are really going to get the language properly and be effective in it. We can't tolerate any half measures in this. We are either going to be brainwashed and soaked in the language, or else we're going to be only semi-effective all our missionary lives. Well, I'm not going to develop that any further. That's worth a whole study by itself. Making a start now, we go to the field. We may go into an existing church. Well, if that's the case, my only suggestion is don't try to take it over. We go out there as people commissioned from churches at home. Apparently, people that have some ability, so they go into another country, and the tendency is then to come and do the tricks there, put them all straight, have all the answers and tell them what to do. My only suggestion is go very quietly. Thankfully, we didn't go into an existing church. You inherit all the problems, and it sometimes is very difficult. It's very difficult also going to a place where there's no church and you've got to start from scratch. We started from nothing, and our approach was to make disciples and then to work through them, to start and to teach these people. And we find that once some of them became Christians, most of them of course didn't, but once they did become Christians, then to work through them. They will make better teachers, better evangelists than we will, better pastors than we will. Not simply because they're nationals, but they must be nationals who are trained in the scriptures. The very fact that he happens to be a national doesn't mean to say he's going to be a better teacher than I am. But if he's trained in the scriptures and he understands, then he's going to be far more effective among his own people. Our point is that we want to train them so that they are able to do the work. And we don't emphasize meetings only. Now we must have some meetings for fellowship among the Christians so that they grow. But most of our work was done in private groups, one or two here, one or two there. And likewise in Australia we found the same. Among the unchurched, the non-Christians, getting into their houses, sitting around the kitchen table with a few Bibles, my wife and myself and another couple, explaining, going through the Bible, what Christianity is all about. And then as people become Christians, not all of them do of course, but some do become Christians, continuing and teaching them how to read the Bible. Not just hoping they're going to read a chapter a day, but actually showing them how to understand it, how to go about it. And then showing them how to pray. And as time goes on, showing them how to conduct person-to-person studies themselves, and how to prepare a talk. and actually helping them in the mechanics of preparing a talk or preparing a prayer to offer in the service of the church. We must be very positive in our approach to these matters, particularly in relation to the brand new convert. We've got to show those converts that we have faith in them. We've taught them to have faith in God, and we've got to show the same faith. We teach them that God can carry them through. Okay, we've got to show that we trust that God will carry them through. Not that the convert has to be propped up by us the whole time. We give them the texts, the proof texts of salvation. You'll never perish, and neither will anyone pluck you out of the Father's hand. These things are written that you may know that you have eternal life, and so we go on. And then sometimes we hesitate to baptize them because we're frightened perhaps that they might fall away. I don't believe that we have to wait until a person is mature before we baptize them. The New Testament teaches that we baptize them as converts. We must make sure that their conversion is genuine, that they know what they've done, and then we baptize them. That's one of the steps towards maturity in their Christian lives. It gives them confidence. We don't have to wait around for 1 or 2 years, hoping they're going to grow, and then baptize them. If we baptize them, I think we'll find they will grow. What I'm worried about is that we're going to contradict in practice what we teach them in theory. We teach them assurance, eternal security. You'll never perish, you'll never fall away, you are God's and you're saved. But then we're frightened to baptize them just in case they prove not to be saved or they do fall away. And so we contradict in practice what we teach them in theory. And I'm saying that we must be very careful to show the confidence in them that we expect them to have in their salvation. Concerning conversions and the progress of people, we should be very much guided by the local people. They can read their own people far better than we can. And if we get a consistent message back from a number of people who are perceptive enough to see certain indications within someone, then I believe we should take notice of that, even if we ourselves haven't seen what they have seen. People of the same ethnic or cultural background can read each other extremely well. Another note here concerning our teaching. I believe that we ought to teach them the scriptures as the scriptures have been given to us. We must not think that they are not capable of understanding the exposition of the scriptures, that we've got to stick to a few favourite topics about prayer and assurance and witnessing and victory over temptation. We do give them those teachings, but I believe it's giving them the Bible as God gave it to us. That's our main responsibility, and we must not think they can't understand it. That's a very patronising attitude to have. In fact, I found that many of the people in these third world countries are far easier to teach than people at home. People at home have built up a barrier, they've built up a resistance at times, they've got a false attitude to the Bible, they've built up a mystique, a mystery about the whole thing. They don't really expect to understand it. But these people come to it fresh, without all that accumulation of centuries of tradition. I find they understand it very readily. And that's to be expected, because the books were written mostly to ordinary Christians, ordinary everyday people. Many of them perhaps were only semi-literate, and yet they understood what the writers were saying. The letters Paul wrote, most of those churches he wrote to were only a few weeks or a few months or at the very outside, a few years old. Some of the great teaching of Romans and Ephesians and Colossians given to young churches, and they understood it. And Paul expected them to understand it, and we've proved that they do understand it. In fact, I found here in Australia that even among the non-Christian people, you go through those books and they understand. The Bible is not a difficult book. It's a very profound book, but it's not difficult. The truths it presents, God became flesh, that's a very profound truth. But the understanding of what the Bible is saying is not difficult at all. We're the ones that have made it difficult because of all the misconceptions we've brought to it. So we must not hesitate to teach the Bible as it was given. And they respond. A note here concerning some of the concepts that people have. Now in Thailand, for example, we found a difficulty with the concept of sacrifice. Thai people don't like to kill anything. And the Old Testament sacrifice was a bit of a stumbling block to some. Now, you don't water down the doctrine, but you have to deal with it in a certain way. Some things require more attention. On the other hand, matters that Paul speaks to the Corinthians about concerning food offered to idols, we have to spend weeks explaining that at home here, but no explanation necessary for them because it's the world they live in. Some of the stories you read, cultural overtones, for example, the lady who washed Jesus' feet and wiped them with her hair. Tremendous impact upon the Thais, that one, because they consider their head sacred and the feet the lowest part of the body, and that is a story which conveys humility and adoration in a way that I don't think we, as Westerners, can ever quite enter into. On the other hand, they find things such as the holy kiss difficult to understand. People in Europe may not find that difficult to understand because that's part of their cultural setup. People in Southeast Asia don't kiss at all, not in that fashion anyway, or publicly in any form at all. Lots of little bits and pieces. I'm not going to get bogged down in these sorts of things. But we've got to be very careful concerning some of the possible misunderstandings that people have from their former religion. It's very difficult at times to draw the line between culture and religion. Now, they may sit cross-legged. They may take off their shoes when they go inside a building, and they may do so at church. Now, there's nothing religious about that. That's simply the way their culture is anyway. Even if you go into a house, those are certain customs they follow. If they sit on a chair, they don't sit cross-legged with one leg on the floor and the other leg propped up on the first one with the toe pointing around willy-nilly at the congregation. That would be highly impolite. You have to observe these local customs. There's nothing wrong with them, there's nothing religious about them, and the church must accommodate to those sorts of things. Other issues, however, are more directly concerned with the religion. Some of the paraphernalia they stick around their walls, things of that nature. Very difficult at times to draw a line between what is cultural and what is religious. In our operation of the church, we've got to be very careful that we don't simply try to impose some Western form upon them. We've got to let them develop it themselves, be discerning, as they will be discerning, in sorting out what is simply a cultural adaptation and what has religious connotations built into it. Moving on to my next point now, how far do we help these locals? That is, how far do we give them practical help in the church or in our finances, things of that nature? Well, I believe we should always see ourselves simply as helpers in the church. It's their church, not ours, and we mustn't convey the impression that everything has to pass the missionary's approval before it can be done. It's very easy to convey that impression. Naturally, they will defer to us. That's part, again, of their general cultural background. Even though they may disagree, they will defer quite often. We think they're approving, but they're not really. They're just going along. We've got to be careful that we don't unconsciously even impose our will upon them. It's not our church. We're there simply as helpers. If we do too much, they're going to become dependent upon us. It's much better for us to keep in the background and leave them to work things out. Let it be their church from the beginning, and we simply help them along. Moving into the domestic situation, or even in the Christian service situation, how wise is it to employ Christians? Well, here again, there's no clear-cut answer. Let's take some work that's not in the church, and you have an opportunity, perhaps you're in a printing press or something like that. Should you employ Christians or should you employ non-Christians? Well, you may employ Christians and find that some of them become sponges and they expect better deals than anybody else. Well, then again, you may find you employ non-Christians, whereupon the Christian people say, look, we're unemployed, why don't you give us work? You go and give it to those who aren't even Christians. There's no easy answer. Everything is going to depend on what the work is, who is available, can they do the work, and are these the sorts of people that are likely to be helped or hindered by such employment. Should we give the church money out of our own personal funds? A very difficult one. Normally, we will have more money than most of the people in the church. If a missionary gave the same percentage of his income as the locals gave of their income, perhaps 95% of the offering would come from the missionary. Now, that obviously would be a false indication of the affluence of the church. So he's got to keep his offering somehow comparable with what the other people are giving. But yet if he gives only the minimum amount that they give, the small offerings, well, of course, it's not a very good example. If they find out that he's only giving that amount, and they know he gets an awful lot more, it's not really a good example to them. You see, again, no clear-cut answer. We had a case where the church had to lease some property. That is, they wanted to move into their own building, and so they had to lease it over a 13-year term, and you put down about 90% of the money in one lump sum at the beginning. The sum was quite reasonable when you took it over 13 years. It was a reasonable price to pay. But to find all that money at the beginning was a mountainous obstacle. Now, the Christians were giving very well. I could have written letters home. I could have got a loan from certain Christian organizations back in the home country. But would that have really helped? Would that have been the best thing to do to help the local church? I could have forked out of my own funds substantially to help them. But would that have been the right thing to do? They were giving very sacrificially, and we were giving also substantially, but comparable to the amounts that they were giving. I discussed the possibility with others, and in the end, what I decided I would do was to go and work at the university for 3 hours a day, just give 3 hours lectures each afternoon for 6 months, and then donate all the money from that into the church fund. Now, one person, one other European, not a missionary, but a European associate that I had there, he said, oh, you're just becoming the big white chief again. It's just like handing them a lump sum out of your Westerners' funds. But I said, I don't think it is. And the local people certainly didn't see it that way. In fact, they appreciated it, and it helped them all the more. I believe what I was doing was comparable with what Paul did, where he worked with his own hands to give them an example. I didn't just give them a handout, but as a member of the church, equal with them, I went and did something extra. It put an awful lot of strain on my time because I was determined to keep up my ordinary program of teaching and writing, Bible study groups and the like. And so I put extra strain on my program, but at the same time I was able to use my hands to earn some money which we could donate to the church and could assist to get this amount of money. And in due course, it succeeded. But you see, there's no easy answer to these problems. We've got to think them through very carefully. We started off the church in our own home. Since it's in my home, I'd better buy some chairs for people to sit on. So I go out and buy 20 chairs. Was that a wise thing to do? You see, I own the chairs. The impression is, I own the church. Perhaps it would have been wiser for us to take around the hat and buy 20 chairs in the name of the group. We bought the hymn books. Was that a wise thing to do? I donate them to the church, but I bought them in the first place. Perhaps it would have been wiser to get them to buy their own hymn books. The bread and the wine. It was in our house. Naturally, we just took a bit of bread out of the cupboard. We bought some wine. Now, that was a natural thing to do, but was it the wise thing to do? The impression there is that we're running the church. We own the church. It's in our house. The material possessions are ours. When we came back from furlough the first time, by this time the church had moved into this building that they had leased, we found that they had made an adjustment. Even when we moved into the building, because the practice had been established, Gay and I used to take along the bread and wine each week. When we got back from furlough, we found that they no longer bought wine. Wine was expensive. One bottle was equal to about one Sunday's complete offering, which is very expensive. What they did was to just go around the corner to a shop, buy some local concoction of fruit drink, and put that on the table. That struck me as being a very sensible thing to do, and probably much more in keeping with what was practiced in New Testament times. You see, all these little things. Should we build or should we rent? Well, that's a big thing. With us in Bangkok, there was no real problem because we didn't have enough money to buy land and build, so we simply leased this property. I'm sure that the less business we can get into, the fewer troubles we're going to create for ourselves. A few comments here concerning the missionary and local living, that is, how we should live in our normal everyday lives around about the place. Well, quite obviously, we've got to eat the local food. I was shocked one day to find somebody who said, what a sacrifice that must be. Goodness me, what an attitude to have. The food is magnificent, and in most countries, we're going to find that the food is very enjoyable. Sometimes it may take a bit of adjustment, but we've got to learn to eat it, and like it, and eat all sorts. Likewise with our dress more or less the way they do. Now, again, we've got to be sensible. There's no point in trying to ape the local people. They don't appreciate it. I've asked people in several countries this question when missionaries have got themselves decked out in some unusually local style, and the locals don't appreciate it. They said they're only trying to ape us. We are different. We're different sizes, shapes, got different colour hair, different shaped noses. We stick out like a sore toe. There's no point in our doing things that are stupid. But on the other hand, we are not to do anything that's going to offend them or make ourselves look any more obvious than we are. Take a very simple case in Thailand. All the men wear long trousers. Now, this strikes me as being impractical. It's hot, they're uncomfortable, but they all do it. It's considered impolite and childish to wear shorts in public. I found that out the hard way. I'd only been there a week or so, and one day I went out, it was hot as anything, and I wore shorts and long socks. I was the object of everybody's gaze and giggle. It was the only time I ever did it. You see, they just dress in ordinary clothes, and so we just dress more or less the same way as they dress. When I was in India recently, I saw some tourists getting around. Tourists, incidentally, are normally a country's worst advertisement. You wander around Southeast Asia and ask what opinion people have of Australians. It's appalling. Tourists, they're probably our second worst advertisement. I should imagine our foreign troops are about our worst advertisement, but tourists would be a pretty close second. Well, I saw some of these tourists, they were getting around in thongs, dirty shorts, tank top or cheesecloth blouse or whatever they had on, scraggly looking hair. They look pretty unpresentable. And I said to one of the locals, what do the locals think of these people? And he says, we despise them. He said, they really are insulting us. He said, look at us. And he just looked around, and all the people up and down the streets, they were dressed in ordinary, neat clothes. None of the local people were as disheveled looking as these critters walking down the street. It showed that these visitors had no sensitivity towards the locals. They had no respect for the locals' dignity. You see, we've got to be careful that we don't overdo it. Now, the same with our housing. If you go and live in a foul house or something like that, the people aren't going to respect you for it. But again, if you live in a very fancy house that is obviously much better than any of theirs, well, they're not going to respect you for that either. And we have to find a house which is comparable with the sorts of houses they live in, and that we furnish it simply as they do. If they don't have the mod console, we don't have them either. We try and find a level somewhere round about theirs. They don't want it to be lower than theirs, but they expect it to be comparable. If it's a little bit better, we've got one or two more things than they have, well, they're not going to worry too much about that. But it's something that they can feel perfectly at home in. Whether we should decorate the thing up with all sorts of gimmicks from home, that's something we've got to think about. One or two things that are a bit different, well, they're talking points, they're of interest, they're quite interested in looking at artifacts from other countries, but we don't want to make it look like home away from home. We want to be part of the local scene, not to be too far away from the average. In Bangkok, there are cars everywhere. I think a higher density of cars in Bangkok than just about any major city in the world. Nothing wrong with having a car in Bangkok. But there are some country areas. Now, one of our missionaries in a more remote country area where the people were very poor, he used to go into a lot of villages, and he refused to buy a car because he said that would cut me off from the people. And so he had a motorbike, lots of motorbikes around, and he felt that that would eliminate the possibility of a barrier coming between him and the people. There's no law that we can lay down. The missionary has to be sensible and assess the different situations in the different places that he goes. Just a note concerning our adaptation to their cultural practices. Now, this could fill a whole talk, so I'll just discuss it very briefly. The way we sit, for example, I mentioned before about crossing our legs. Now, that to them can be offensive. We've got to learn not to do that sort of thing. Speaking to each other in the home. Now, we speak to each other in English, naturally, but if the locals are there, it's impolite to speak to each other in English in front of them. And so we have to speak in the local language in front of them so that they are not embarrassed, or so that we aren't being impolite to them. The fact that Thai people are offended over killing even of insects. They don't swat mosquitoes. They blow them off or brush them off. Likewise, a cockroach, they let it run away. I remember, again, I learnt my lesson the hard way. I was in a house one night, sitting on the floor with a group of people, all of them non-Christians. I was teaching them the Bible. And a cockroach ran across, and almost instinctively, I suppose, I just swiped it. And the looks on the faces of those people, immediately I knew I had done the wrong thing. I had lost them. Here was I talking to them about sin, and then I go and do something as sinful as that in front of their own eyes. I've offended them grossly. Little things like that. We have to be very alert and very aware of local sensitivities. Many of these things we only learn the hard way. At least if we learn them, that's something. And we'll never learn them if we don't know the language. Virtually all of these cultural issues, we're only going to learn them through the language. A note here concerning missionaries and their fellow missionaries, or other Western Christians. Now, missionary fellowships are very useful, getting together for prayer meetings and discussions. But I don't believe we should look upon them as top priority in our program. If we live in a place where other missionaries are within reach, and we want to get together for prayer and for fellowship, then I think by all means we ought. But not in a way which is going to make this the highlight of our work. It is a peripheral thing, and if it has to be sacrificed, well, then I say let it go by the board. It's not all that important. I believe we should be finding our fellowship in the local church and with the local believers as much as possible. We don't want to convey the impression to them that we are an elite society who meet by ourselves, but then come and do our work among them. You know what I mean? We come and do our work among them, but we find our Christian fulfillment with each other in some prayer huddle somewhere. We are teaching these Christians that God can uphold them. Cast your burdens upon the Lord and he will sustain you. We're giving them this teaching that the Lord can see them through. Many of them have been thrown out of their families because of their Christian commitment. Many of them are suffering in their work and in their schooling, in their own locality because of their faith in Christ. And we're saying to them, oh, God can uphold you. We're encouraging them. How much is that going to have an effect on them if they see us having to go off and get recharged by meeting with our own missionary group? We're supposed to be mature people. We're supposed to be the leaders, the ones that have gone out there to plant the church. If we can't survive without getting together with our own group, what chance have they got of surviving where everything is against them? The whole of their culture and society and their family and their work, everything is against their Christian commitment. We're telling them that they can stand. We've got to show them that the Lord can make them stand, and we're not to do anything which is going to contradict that in their eyes. Another warning, not to use prayer for these local believers as an excuse to gossip about them. Sometimes we'll gossip about local believers in a way that we wouldn't gossip about each other. We don't want to treat them as our work, our converts, something we play with or fiddle with or work with. They are the local church and we are part of them. We are part of that local church within the structure of it. Not over it, but just as much part of it as anybody else, subject to its discipline, part of its life and growth, sharing in its troubles and sorrows, finding our fulfillment and our fellowship among those people. We must respect their dignity, and I particularly mention this in relation to letters we send home, circulars we put out, items we put in news magazines. So often we'll be tempted to write the gory details of some local happening. Perhaps it's been a sex scandal. We write home and we put this down and show how bad the situation is and how much we need prayer for these people. But is that a fair thing to do? Would we do that in our own country? I'm inclined to think we'd do the opposite. We'd do all we could to hush it up. We wouldn't write a letter about some scandal in our local church and then put it in a magazine which goes all around Australia and say, this is what happened in this particular church. We wouldn't do that sort of thing. We don't even let it get out to the church next door if we can possibly help it. And yet, we're inclined to do the same thing at times with these other people. Spell out all the details. Now, we've got to be honest. I don't believe we should paint a rosy picture when the picture's not rosy at all. But I do believe we've got to be discreet and we've got to respect the dignity of these people. They are our brothers and sisters in Christ. And I don't believe that we should be parading the failures of local individuals on the pages of a magazine that goes round into all sorts of other Christian homes and churches in other countries. Another matter here, concerning the discipline of the Christian, or the discipline of the missionary, rather, in his own life. I've got a number of issues that I want to speak about here, and this will be my final section. The missionary's own self-discipline. This is very important because when a missionary goes over into another country, he is very much on his honour. Now, a lot of us here come from a situation where we've been in employment, 9-to-5 job with a regular wage. We have a boss to tell us what to do, and we are answerable. We land on the mission field, and that is not the case. Our income is irregular, and we don't have any boss over us at times, and we may find ourselves in a place where we have to regulate ourselves entirely. I believe it calls for a lot of self-discipline, and if we're not careful, we can slip into very bad habits. First of all, discipline concerning our time. I believe we should be setting ourselves programs so that we don't waste our time. You know Parkinson's Law, well, one of Parkinson's Law. You know Parkinson, the man that wrote those social satires, and he's got all sorts of laws. They're quite humorous and at the same time very true. And one of the laws is that work will always expand itself into the time available. Work will always expand itself into the time available. And if we're not careful, we can find that before we know where we are, we spend a whole day working and doing nothing. Go to the post office, hop around the bank, visit somebody else, stop and talk to somebody, have a cup of tea, write a couple of letters, and before you know where you are, the day has gone. If you're in a big city such as Bangkok or Hong Kong or Calcutta or Delhi or Bombay or one of these places, you know that once you've gone out of your place, out of your house, you've just about ruined the day. It takes you so long to get around and everything is frightfully inconvenient. People who live in our organized cities of the West don't really know what it's like living in one of these huge eastern cities. For that reason, I made it my practice that whenever I went out and did the things that had to be done and stayed out. And when I was home, I stayed home. If I was out doing business, visiting or conducting teaching classes, I organized it to be out on that day and that day and that day. And then when I was home, I said, I'm going to stay home and work on my writings and things this day. Otherwise, you'll find that the whole of your time vanishes. And when it came to doing matters of business, going to the bank and the post office and fixing up all the things that have to be fixed up with all the government officials and departments in these countries, I would put those all on a list and I'd let them add up. And each Monday morning, I'd go out first thing, and all of that was done on the Monday morning. And if anything came in during the week, it got put on the hook and it waited till the next Monday morning. That sort of control that I'm talking about. If we don't discipline ourselves, we'll find that our time can very quickly disappear. The same concerning our income. Now, our income is very irregular. Sometimes we get a lot and sometimes we get a little. It comes infrequently. What we did was to pay all our income into a central fund. After we'd been there a while, we'd worked out a budget. We knew what our expenses were likely to be. And on a monthly basis, we would work our finances. In other words, we'd go to the central fund, we'd withdraw a certain amount. Gay looked after certain areas of our living, I looked after certain areas of our living. We went and drew some money out and operated for that month on that amount that we had budgeted for. Whether our income was up or down for the month didn't really affect the way we lived, because we paid all our income into a central fund and then drew out of that fund to operate our affairs. There was another missionary in Bangkok, nobody that anyone here knows, so don't try and think who I'm talking about. But this person didn't operate on that basis. He was a great believer in living by faith in the more spectacular fashion, and he liked to write stories of how God gave him miraculous provision, and those stories impressed people at home. But when you're on the field, you saw the other side of it. What happened was that if he got a lot of money, he'd blow it. He'd be down the street and buy a new fan here and another fan for another room and then a cassette player and something else. 5 or 6 weeks later, not much more money had come in. Then he'd have some of these things down the second-hand shop trying to get some money back for them. Or he'd be knocking on my door asking for a loan. He used to rubbish me at times because I had a more disciplined approach to our finances. And he used to talk about living by faith as being the only way, but it was just as well I was there to bail him out on 3 or 4 occasions. These stories about God's provision, God's miraculous provision. Praise the Lord, he does provide. But at times it was an act of grace on God's part that he was bailing him out largely from a situation that he'd got himself into through his own stupidity and irresponsibility. We've got to be very practical about these issues. Another very practical issue of self-discipline concerns our relationships with the local people. Any instability in the marriage is sure to be shown up on the mission field. If any person has shown a weakness towards those of the opposite sex, that weakness is sure to develop on the mission field. Husband and wife are going to be thrown upon each other much more than they were at home. It must be complete compatibility. They're going to be open to more temptations in the society than they were at home. The tendency is that you're on the loose. All the people you used to know aren't there to keep an eye on you. And all the temptations are available for people who are lacking in self-discipline to suddenly fall foul of some of these temptations that beset them. Any emotional instability, any person who's shown himself to have a tendency towards change, 2 jobs in the last year, moved house 2 times in the last 2 years, a new car each 6 months, things like that. People that have those tendencies, even though they may have other abilities, I think they ought to be refused in relation to the mission field, because sure as eggs, those problems are going to increase. We're looking for people, not who are the flashy types. Some people are very good in big churches and they can run big programs, but those are not necessarily the people that we're looking for on the mission field. We want people who certainly have their feet on the ground and people who are godly, but people also who know what life's about. I believe a Bible college training can be helpful, but I believe also there must be preparation in the church and also preparation in the hard, cold, secular world out there. One of the desirable features, I would think, is that a person, after completing his education, whether it's secondary or tertiary or whatever, should at least have some years in the workforce before going to Bible college, and then again some years in the workforce after Bible college before going on the mission field. And in each case, of course, fitting into a local church, which is where the game is won or lost. Now, I wouldn't make that a hard and fast rule, and some circumstances may not allow that to be. But either end of the Bible college training, there surely must be some involvement in the world for some time so that people really know what it's like putting the practicalities of Christianity to work. All right, well, I've just about run out of time here. That was a very miscellaneous collection, but I'm sure it's raised a few issues. I hope it's been of help. And in the cup of tea that's following, if you want to come and grab me by the collar and pursue a few of these issues further, then I'll be only too pleased to talk about them.